For centuries, theology was regarded as the queen of sciences. During the Middle Ages, schools of higher learning taught the liberal arts, which were divided into the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and the quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, and of all things, music and astronomy. And of course, they taught theology, which was the queen of sciences. Now, of course, over the centuries, things have changed. The very meaning of the word science has changed since the Middle Ages. Today, most university students regard theology, particularly Christian theology, as a waste of time. Even many Bible-believing Christians have no time for theology. I will not ask you if you have ever picked up a theology book. I'm glad I can't actually see you at this point to know what your answer might be. Some of you have picked up a theology book because you have taken a course in systematic theology or in Bible doctrine. Yet you regard theology as dusty, musty, and rusty. In your mind, you did your time, and you have no intention of going back to theology jail. But I take a very different view of theology. The words of A.W. Tozer have always resonated with me. What I believe about God is the most important thing about me. Will you repeat those words with me? I realize you may be sitting in front of a television or a computer or perhaps even watching on your phone. Well, no one will find it odd if you speak into your phone. So will you repeat that quotation from A.W. Tozer with me? What I believe about God is the most important thing about me. One more time. What I believe about God is the most important thing about me. I will tell you that in the midst of this crisis in which we find ourselves today, that truth most certainly applies. The most important truths for us to know in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic are not the latest announcements from the Center on Disease Control or the World Health Organization. They are not the latest releases from the task force that the president has put together. It's certainly not the latest statistics on how many have died from COVID-19 or how many confirmed cases there are in Greenville County. It's not even where we might be able to find toilet paper. The most important truths for us to know in the midst of this crisis concern who God is, how He relates to us. What we believe about God is the most important thing about us in the middle of this crisis. And so this morning, rather than continue our study in the book of Acts, we're going to turn our attention to one of the most encouraging revelations about God in all the pages of Scripture, Psalm 91. So please have your Bibles open to Psalm 91 where you can read with me, so where you can refer back to these verses as we make our way through this psalm. Before we read the 16 verses which comprise this psalm, let me point out the structure of the psalm. The psalm will be more meaningful as we read it together if you first understand the structure. And the structure is reflected in the outline of the message that I've given you this morning. In verse 1, we have a theological statement, a poetic proposition about God, about who He is, about how He relates to us. In verse 2, the psalmist responds to this theological proposition, responds to this truth about God. We don't know who wrote this psalm or when, But it really makes very little difference because the psalmist is not responding to his circumstances. He's responding to his God. Then in verses 3 through 13, the psalmist addresses you. In nearly every verse from verse 3 through verse 13, the word you or your appears. The psalmist turns from his response to God to teach you and me about God. And then in the final three verses, in verses 14 through 16, God himself speaks. Notice, beginning in verse 14, the pronoun I appears again. But this time, it is the divine I. It is God speaking to us in the first person. No longer is the psalmist testifying to us. In verses 14 through 16, God himself speaks directly to us. So let's read together, beginning in Psalm 91 and verse 1. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in the darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place, no evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. You shall tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent you shall trample underfoot. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. So this entire beautiful psalm finds its foundation in the psalmist's proposition, a theological proposition that we find in verse 1. Beautiful words. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. First of all, this theological proposition concerns the person of God. Now, this proposition uses two names for God that are out of the ordinary. The person of God is described by these two unusual titles. The first is the Most High. El Elyon is the title in Hebrew. And this word is actually a simple adjective in the Hebrew language, the language of the Old Testament. It is a word that means uppermost or means highest. The Most High is a great translation. We encounter this name for God for the very first time in the Bible in Genesis 14. I won't ask you to turn. But this is the story of Abraham trying to rescue Lot from the four kings who had conquered Sodom and Gomorrah. With 318 men from his household, Abraham defeated these kings. And when he returned with the captives and with the plunder, we're told that Melchizedek, the king of Salem, went out to meet Abraham, and he blessed him. And this is what he said. Blessed be Abraham of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. So this name, El Elyon, emphasizes three truths about the true and living God. Number one, he is absolutely and supremely sovereign. There is none higher than our God. Number two, he is the possessor of heaven and earth. He created all things and possesses all things. And number three, it is he who grants victory. Victory over our enemies is in his hand. The second title here in verse 1 is translated the Almighty at the end of the verse, El Shaddai. Now, this title is not based on any Hebrew word. In fact, we are unsure of its derivation. It may be based on a Middle Eastern word that means mountain. And so, the idea in this title is big. El Elyon is the most high God. El Shaddai is the most big God. Now, El Shaddai is a very ancient title for the true and living God. It's used numerous times in the book of Genesis, and it's used dozens of times in the book of Job. And Job may chronologically be the oldest book in the Bible. And from its use in the book of Job, we understand that this title refers to the God who does according to his own will and answers to no man. El Shaddai is the most big God who does according to his own will in dealing with men. But there's something very different about this theological proposition in verse 1. It is not the kind of statement about God that we're used to reading in a systematic theology book. And that is because, in the second place, this theological proposition is written in poetry. Not the kind of poetry that we have in English that's based primarily in rhyme and in meter, but rather the kind that's common in Hebrew, that's primarily a matter of metaphor and of structure. In this proposition, the poetry is focused primarily in two metaphors. The first is translated secret place in our New King James Version. Many of the modern translations translate the word shelter in this place, but secret place, as our New King James translates it, is actually the best translation. This word is repeatedly translated tens of times in the Old Testament as secret. For instance, when Saul was trying to kill David, Jonathan warned David and said, "My father Saul seeks to kill you, therefore please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide." This word means a place where we can hide from danger. El Elyon, the Most High God, the sovereign God who is the possessor of heaven and earth, who delivers from enemies, this God is the secret place where we can hide from danger. Then at the end of the verse, we have a second metaphor. The shadow of the Almighty, the shadow of El Shaddai. Now, this word is consistently translated shadow nearly 50 times in the Old Testament, and all the modern translations follow suit. But what does it mean to abide under the shadow of the Almighty? Well, we need to transport ourselves back to the ancient Middle East, to a time when air conditioning was many hundreds of years in the future, at a time when there were few trees to be found, a time and place when the temperatures were often well above 120 degrees. In such a place, shadow was protection from the natural elements, from the burning rays of the sun. El Shaddai is that mountain of a God who protects us from nature itself. And so here in verse 1, we see two aspects of protection. And in fact, we see these two aspects of protection emphasized again and again throughout this entire psalm. God is high enough to hide us from human enemies. And God is big enough to protect us against nature when it turns against us. But there's one more element to this theological proposition in verse 1. This theological proposition involves a personal relationship, a personal relationship to God. Now, thus far, we've been talking about God, and that's as it should be, since verse 1 is a theological proposition. But verse 1 begins with the word he, and in this case, he is not referring to God. The he is the one who has a relationship with God, the relationship that's described in this proposition. And that relationship is couched in two verbs in this sentence, dwells and shall abide. These two verbs extend the metaphors that we just discussed. You know, often we state Christianity in terms of a faith relationship. Do you believe in God? But in this theological proposition, our faith relationship with God is pictured in a different question. Do you dwell in God? Do you live day by day in the love, in the protection, in the provision that a relationship with this God offers? Now, of all times, we ought to understand this idea right now. When there is a constant talk about quarantine and about self-isolation, we all wish that there was some place where we could go that would offer absolute safety and security from COVID-19. And that's very much the idea here in verse 1. That place of safety and security does not exist in the physical world. It cannot be found anywhere on earth at this time. But it does exist in the spiritual realm, in the safety and security of a loving, trusting relationship with God Most High, with Almighty God, with a God high enough, with a God big enough to keep us completely safe and secure. And that is the relationship that verse 1 describes. So that's the theological proposition in verse 1, and it's one of the most comforting and reassuring theological propositions in the Scriptures. But verse 2 is the psalmist's response to the theological proposition in verse 1. Verses 1 and 2 form a couplet in Hebrew poetry. Hebrew poetry often uses restatement by pairing verses into a couplet. And in this case, verse 2 restates the truths in verse 1, but also extends the truths in verse 1. Verse 2 extends the truth in verse 1 by adding one simple word. That word appears three times in verse 2. The word, my. The psalmist says, the God described in verse 1 is my God. El Elyon is my God. El Shaddai is my God. The hiding place that this God offers is my hiding place. Now, the secret place and shadow mentioned in verse 1 are restated as the refuge and the fortress in verse 2, but the meaning is essentially the same. Ultimately, protection from human enemies, protection from natural adversity is found in God alone. And the psalmist claims that such protection is his. God is my refuge. God is my fortress. Now, the last word of verse 2 assures us that the relationship that is being pictured in these verses is one of trust. This is what faith in God looks like. This is what faith in God feels like. And yet, as I have meditated on these verses this week, I have asked myself the question, does everyone who has a faith relationship with God, does every one of us enjoy the assurance and the comfort that the psalmist describes in these first two verses? Another way to state this question is this the experience of every truly saved individual? And I have to answer no, I don't think so. I think the faith of the psalmist here in verse 2 goes beyond saving faith. It is an additional step of faith. And that's the challenge that I want to place in front of you today, in the middle of this medical crisis. We need to advance to a higher level of faith in our God. We need to be able to say to God with the psalmist, "You are my refuge. You are my fortress. You are my God. In you I will trust." How will you respond to this challenge this morning? Well, beginning in verse 3, we find the psalmist's testimony to you and to me. The words "you" and "your" appear at least 18 times in verses 3 through 13. In these verses, the psalmist speaks to you. And "you," in this case, includes all of God's people. The psalmist giving a testimony in these verses to all of God's people in order to draw them into this higher level of faith, this faith relationship that the psalmist had. Now, I don't have time in this message to exposit every phrase of every verse in this section of 11 verses. Rather, I'm going to make four general applications of these verses. First, I remind you, the psalmist's testimony is poetry, not promise. Poetry, not promise. One of the commentaries that I read said that the psalmist in Psalm 91 was full of the exuberance of faith. And that's true. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. That's exuberant faith. But is that a promise that we should take literally? I think it's important to notice the little word "may" at the beginning of that sentence. This verse describes what may happen, what God may do, what God can do. When I read this verse, I'm reminded of the story of Jonathan that's told in 1 Samuel chapter 14. Jonathan, with just his armor bearer, went up against an entire garrison of 600 Philistine soldiers and routed them single-handedly, killing 20 of them and putting to flight the entire Philistine army that day. Certainly, verse 7 was Jonathan's testimony that day. 1,000 may fall at my side and 10,000 at my right hand, but it shall not come near me. But we need to remember that just a few chapters later, in 1 Samuel 31, Jonathan was killed in battle against the Philistines. So these verses are a poetic recounting of the exuberant faith of the psalmist. They are a poetic recounting of what God can do and what God often does for his people. Can God deliver us from the pestilence that walks in the darkness? To use the words of verse 6, certainly he can, and he does. Can God ensure that no evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling? As verse 10 puts it, certainly he can and he does. And we ought to be praying for him to do just that in the midst of this pandemic. But these verses are not intended as literal promises. They are instead intended to communicate the feeling, to conjure up in our hearts the spirit of safety and security that is ours when God Most High is our hiding place, is our refuge. Charles Spurgeon once upon a time summarized what I'm trying to say. He said it in a sermon, and he said it specifically in the context of contagious and infectious disease. Here's what he said. Whatever occurs around us, we need not be alarmed. We are immortal until our work is done. That's what the psalmist is trying to convey here. Our immortality, when we are in the center of God's will, and until God is finished with us. In the second place, the second application that we can make from these 11 verses, the psalmist's testimony in these 11 verses is an example of encouragement. You know, there are times when we need to testify to one another of our faith in God. There are times when we need to express the same kind of exuberant faith that the psalmist does in these verses. And we are in such a time right now. Our government has called us to social distancing, and we ought to obey our government. They are God's ministers to us for good, Romans 13 teaches us. They are seeking to protect the health of the public, and we ought to cooperate with their efforts. But practicing social distancing does not mean that we need to be cut off socially from one another. In 1876, a man named Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, and now is the time to use that invention. Cooped up in our homes, there is something better to do than to binge watch Andy of Mayberry. We can still talk to one another. We can still practice at a distance the fellowship of the local church. And when we do, we need to encourage one another. And we need to use the kind of words that the psalmist gives to us here in Psalm 91. We can testify to one another that God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. when we fellowship at a distance, when we talk to one another over the phone, when we text, let's be certain that our conversations are not full of woe is me. I'm stuck in these four walls and I'm going stir crazy. But rather full of God shall cover you with his feathers and under his wings you shall take refuge. Let us obey 1 Thessalonians 5:11, which exhorts us to encourage one another and build one another up. And we don't have to be all in the same church building to do that. We don't have to be sitting around the same table at a fellowship meal. We can find creative and inventive ways to fellowship with one another and to encourage one another, even while practicing social distancing. In the third place, the psalmist's testimony in verses 3 through 13 includes a condition. The key verse in this section is right in the middle. Verse 3 to verse 13, the middle verse is verse 9, and it says, "Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place." As I said a few moments ago, the psalmist is testifying to all of God's people in this section. But verse 9 makes clear that the security and comfort expressed in these verses does not automatically belong to all of God's people. "Because you have made the Lord your dwelling place," verse 9 says. Some of the modern versions even use the word "if" here, instead of the word "because." It is only if we make the Lord our dwelling place that we will enjoy the kind of assurance and comfort that's expressed in these verses. Verse 9, again, makes explicit the point that I made just a few moments ago. The faith described in verses 3 through 13 is not the saving faith of all genuine believers. This kind of assurance and comfort flows from a higher level of faith, a faith that dwells in God. That's the metaphor that's repeated here in verse 9. The Lord is my refuge. The Most High is my dwelling place. When these words are true in our lives, then and only then will we enjoy the comfort and the security expressed in these verses. The psalmist calls us to higher ground. And we might say that the crisis in which we find ourselves today calls us to higher ground, to a higher level of faith in which we dwell moment by moment in God as our fortress, as our hiding place. And then there is a final important application of verses 3 through 13. The psalmist's testimony must be interpreted through Jesus' temptation. Through the temptation of Jesus. Verses 11 and 12 ought to be a bit more familiar to us than the rest of this psalm, because these are the verses that Satan quoted to Jesus when he sought to tempt him. I'd like for you for just a moment to keep your finger here in Psalm 91 and to turn over to the New Testament with me to Matthew chapter 4. So turn over with me for just a moment to Matthew chapter 4. Notice in Matthew 4, verses 5 through 7, we read these words. "Then the devil took Jesus up into the holy city, set him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone.' Jesus said to him, 'It is written, you shall not tempt the Lord your God.'" You know, the devil is not wise, but he is certainly shrewd. Because it's easy when we read through verses 3 through 13 in Psalm 91 to presume. To make the presumption that God is going to protect me no matter what I do. It's easy to arrive at that view when you read Psalm 91, if you'll flip back there now. I mean, look at verses 5 through 7. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. The devil asked Jesus to test these biblical promises by throwing himself down from the pinnacle of the temple. In so many words, the devil said to Jesus, if you have real faith, then prove it by taking these promises literally right here and right now. You do take God at his word, right? That is certainly the idea that Satan wanted Jesus to draw from this passage when he quoted Psalm 91, verses 11 and 12 to him. But Jesus' response to Satan teaches us that there is such a thing as tempting God, as presuming on God's mercy. If we deliberately take risks, if we refuse to take common sense measures to care for our health and safety, and then we expect God to intervene and to take care of us and to ensure our safety, then we are tempting God. I wonder, in the middle of this crisis, have you heard somebody express this kind of an attitude? It doesn't really make any difference if I obey the pandemic guidelines, if I follow what the president or the governor has outlined. I'm a child of God. God is going to take care of me. Jesus rejected that kind of attitude as tempting God, as presuming on God's mercy. I don't want you to get the idea as I preach through Psalm 91 today that we don't have the responsibility to take common sense precautions in the midst of this pandemic. God is our refuge and our hiding place, yes. But Jesus teaches us that if we will not use caution and care for our health and safety, and then we somehow expect that God is going to be our refuge and our hiding place, that we are actually tempting God and presuming on his mercy. Well, turn back with me now to Psalm 91 if you're not already back there. In the final three verses of the psalm, we hear from the psalmist's God. The psalmist's God. Beginning in verse 14, God speaks. Out of the blue, God speaks. And it's wonderful. It is one thing to have clear, biblical, propositional truth like we do in verse 1. We should never underestimate the value of having God's word in black and white. It is the firm foundation beneath our feet. But what's even more important is direct experience with God. Or let me put it another way. If we put our faith in the propositional truth that we have in the Scriptures, then we will have direct experience with God. God will respond to us. God will bring us to Himself, cause us to know Him. In verses 14 through 16, here in Psalm 91, testify to that great truth. In verse 14, God carefully defines again the set of people who experience the safety and security that He Himself describes and promises in these verses. these people have a certain relationship with him. And he describes them as those who have set their love upon God. Now the verb here in verse 14 in this phrase is difficult to translate. If you check the translations, there are many different translations. This verb is not the common verb that's used throughout the Old Testament for loving God. Rather, this verb speaks of attachment. It speaks of those who are attached to God by their love. Those whose love causes them to attach themselves to God. The verb really pictures a child clinging to his mother's neck, refusing to be separated from her. And this word picture is really a natural complement to the metaphor that runs throughout this entire psalm, that metaphor of dwelling in God. If we dwell in God, then we are attached to him. We refuse to be separated from him. We cling to him. And so God's words here in verse 14 reinforce everything that we've learned since verse 1. But they take us even a step further. Because essentially verse 14 tells us that if we would know the security and the comfort described in this psalm, if we would make God our dwelling place and our hiding place, then our relationship with God not only needs to be a faith relationship, it must be a love relationship. A faith relationship plus a love relationship. Whatever it means to make God our hiding place, to make God our refuge, it is both a faith relationship and a love relationship. And again, reinforcing everything that the psalmist had already said to this point, in verses 14 through 16, God makes 8 promises to those who dwell in him, to those who are attached to him in love. Now, I don't have time this morning, again, to go into detail in regard to these 8 promises. They include answered prayer and God's presence, his deliverance, his protection. They include long life. But ultimately, these 8 promises end with one all-encompassing word, the last word in the psalm. God ultimately promises salvation. The idea here at the very end of the psalm is that God is our dwelling place if we have this faith, not just in this life, but unto all eternity. What a beautiful thought we find here at the end of the psalm. If we dwell in God through the kind of relationship that's been expressed through this entire psalm, in a faith relationship, in a love relationship, then we will never be disappointed because we will never cease to dwell in God. You know, if you read the last chapters of the Bible, Revelation chapters 21 and 22, this is the idea that you come away with, that ultimately as believers, God is our refuge. He's our hiding place right now. We dwell in him if we have the kind of faith that the psalmist is talking about. But we will dwell in God forever. That's what the new heavens and the new earth is all about. I often quote the great Baptist preacher, Charles Spurgeon. I quoted him earlier in this message this morning. Spurgeon was perhaps the greatest preacher of the late 1800s, of the last half of the 19th century. In 1854, Spurgeon had only been pastoring in London for about a year. And there was an outbreak of Asiatic cholera in the community where his church was located. And many in Spurgeon's congregation were affected, and some of them died. And the young pastor spent his days visiting the sick and either conducting funerals or attending funerals. And you can imagine, in time, Spurgeon was overwhelmed. He was heartsick. He was ready to sink into depression, I think. He was a man given to depression. He was ready to sink into depression under the load that was upon him at that time. One day, as he was returning home from a funeral, he noticed a sign in a shoemaker's shop, printed in the owner's own handwriting, was Psalm 91, verses 9 and 10. Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation, there shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. That day, Spurgeon found refuge in God. He wrote these words about that experience. The effect upon my heart was immediate. Faith appropriated the passage as her own. I felt secure, refreshed, girt with immortality. I went on my visitation of the dying in a calm and peaceful spirit. I felt no fear of evil, and I suffered no harm. Unquote. Some of us find ourselves in a similar situation this morning to the great preacher Charles Spurgeon. We need to answer a simple question in the place where we find ourselves today. Are we going to dwell in the midst of this pandemic, or are we going to dwell in God, who is our hiding place? In the days ahead, we can place our focus on the sickness and on the death that is around us. We can spend our time watching Fox News and CNN and listening to the litany day after day of bad news 24/7. Or we can seek to find our dwelling in God. We can get ourselves into His Word and find the time in the middle of this pandemic to get God's Word into us. We can spend our time in meditation, in prayer, communing, fellowshipping with God, sensing Him as our dwelling place. My friend, this morning, will you say with the psalmist, God Most High is my secret place, my hiding place, my refuge. Will you cling to Him in love? God offers you great comfort, security, and assurance if you will spend your days and your time in the next couple of weeks, in the next couple of months, in exactly that manner.